Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? You're listening to Around the World with Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more on Around the World with Dan Perry.
Welcome back to the show again, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm sitting here in a yurt, or as they locally call it, a ger, in a little village in Mongolia. And as you can probably hear, right behind me, they are doing some construction. And in fact, some guys are putting up an outhouse made of metal. It's probably going to be stronger than a brick shithouse, but a little bit louder too. Obviously, they're grinding away. I found that as I travel through, especially developing countries, it's just impossible to get away from noise. You don't get too many quiet moments to yourself. If you're a massive introvert, travel will either make you go insane or it will change you and make you become a little bit more extroverted. Get used to having people around. I wish I could just wait for the noise to stop and for me to find a soundproof chamber, but hey, life doesn't always work that way, and I think this is the only chance I'm going to get to record this podcast. So bear with me, folks. Sorry about the noise. Let's see. Today, I want to talk about Russia. This is going to be the last podcast that I do about Russia. A couple of shows ago, I had given you guys an update on our third week or so as my wife, Katie, and I moved through the biggest country in the world by train. Now, I just want to give you a quick update on what we did during our last week in Russia. And then after my solo introduction here, which I'll try to keep fairly brief, Katie and I are going to talk about Russia in general. We're going to give you an overview of what we thought from our month that we spent in the country, all the good and bad stuff, and most of it was really, really positive. We both very much enjoyed the country. All right, so where I left off in the story of our trip through Russia was that we were in Irkutsk, and we had gotten delayed by a day trying to go to Okhon Island. Well, the next day we were able to go to the island. Irkutsk is pretty close to Lake Baikal, which is the largest lake in the world by volume. It's very easy to spot on a map or a globe. It's this giant banana-looking body of water, and it contains more water than all five Great Lakes combined, which is just crazy to think about. Okhon Island is the biggest island on the lake, and it's really remote, and we just wanted to get away from the city, get away from the noise, and spend some time in nature. So we boarded a minibus. The driver drove like a bat out of hell, constantly swerving around cars and getting us out of the city in no time flat. Then we spent about 6 hours driving on this country road. And how country was this road? Well, first, a couple hours in, some cows started crossing the road, and we dodged the cows. I was a little disappointed. We almost had hamburger, or steak, maybe. A little while later, a pig crossed the road right in front of us, and our driver swerved around the pig. We missed out on our chance to get some bacon. And then, honestly, not very much after that, a horse just ran right into the road, and our driver swerved around the horse, and we missed out on glue. I wish I could have gotten some glue, because a lot of my stuff is falling apart and we could really use it. But anyway, at least our driver was competent. It was crazy how he was able to predict the movement of these animals that I really had no idea which direction they were going to go or how fast, but he seemed to know exactly when. He was really in tune with his environment as he drove. And eventually we reached a dock at the edge of the lake and drove onto a ferry that took us to the island. It was very much reminiscent of the Merrimack ferry that I've taken many times in Wisconsin. Well, we got off the ferry, and all of that crazy driving, I think, finally caught up with our driver because the transmission began to fail. He couldn't get it out of first gear for a while. And this was a big problem because the pavement ran out and all of the roads on the island are unpaved. And there were some giant hills to cross at first. So we drove up to the top of this hill in first gear, just sputtering along, moving slower and slower and slower. And we're like, oh, are we going to make it? There were about 10 of us on this van and it was packed with gear, so not much power to it. Well, eventually we ran out of power before we got to the top. Driver put it in neutral. We drifted or rolled all the way back down this long hill, and then our driver threw it in reverse. We backed up a couple hundred meters, and then he made us all get out at that point. He said, we weigh too much, basically. So we all had to go out, and then he gunned it and was finally able to make it to the top of the hill in first gear, and everybody had to walk up behind him. The next hill, we barely made it to the top of as well. And eventually, after a long day of bad roads and swerving around animals, finally we reached the biggest town, I guess you could call it, on this island. There was a lot of construction going on there. I guess this island wasn't as remote as we had thought it was, but tourism appears to be really taking off on Okhon Island, and I guess for good reason. It is a beautiful place. The bus dropped us off, and most people were going to stay in a guest house or a hotel. Katie and I just decided we don't want to do any of that. We just want to go into the forest and just be alone for a little bit. So we grabbed our stuff and started walking north. The roads were sandy. The ground was really sandy. The soil was poor quality, but there were some pretty big forests nonetheless. And a lot of just roads that just spurred off in random directions, no signage whatsoever, but we just walked for maybe an hour or so and found a nice spot on the shore and set up our tent. Obviously, it was obvious that some other people had camped there because there was a bit of trash on the ground. There was an outhouse there that you're going to hear about later. I won't get into it right now, but listen to the rest of this podcast and you'll find out what happened. We had a really beautiful campsite. We watched the sun go down behind the lake, filtered water from this lake to cook our dinner. And it was really a beautiful place, secluded in the middle of nowhere. The next day we spent all day just walking around. I guess most people who go to the island hire a van and they drive all the way to the northernmost point and then back in the same day. I guess we could have walked there if we had really wanted. It would have taken about 3 days in each direction, but we didn't really want to spend that much time there. Well, we just couldn't spend that much time there because we were running out of time on our visa. But we spent a whole day checking out the island, and we saw a stone circle. It reminded me of a stone crop circle, actually, a bunch of concentric circles of stones, and it was obviously used for some sort of religious ritual. We didn't know what. So there obviously were some people here for a long time ago. Now there were a lot of cows, a lot of animals grazing, and some villagers. We walked up to the other little tiny village in town, and it was super run down. Not much going on there. We didn't even see any people outside. A sleepy place, and that's exactly what we wanted. And we had a beautiful couple days there. Lake Baikal was definitely the highlight of Russia for us. We spent at least a week around the lake or going to various places on the lake. It was awesome. Again, you're going to hear more about that when Katie and I give our review of Russia in a little bit. Then the next day we caught a minibus all the way back to Irkutsk. Not too many animals to dodge this time for some reason. It was a much quicker trip. And then the next day we took the train to Ulan-Ude, and Katie and I talk about it a bunch in our review, but this was by far the best train ride that we've done in Russia, and maybe for both of us our entire lives. It was awesome. I loved looking out over the lake and listening to the clickety-clack of the train as we went over the tracks. That was definitely the highlight of Russia for me was, well, the two highlights were the train and then Lake Baikal. And the train around Lake Baikal was best of both worlds. So we got to Ulan-Ude, which was our last stop in Russia. And we ended up couch surfing there with a Buddhist Lama. He had built his own house with a couple friends, but just built it from scratch at the edge of town. I just love seeing the craftsmanship there. I'm not very good with my hands, so I have a lot of admiration for people who can do such a thing. One interesting part about the house was, I guess the water table in this area is really, really deep, like 150 meters down. So most people don't bother drilling to all the way down to make a well. And so he had a huge tank. I don't even know how many gallons or liters it would hold, but it was like 3 months worth of water in this tank in a storage room in his house. And every 3 months, a truck, I guess, comes and fills it up. And that's their drinking water. That's going to be their toilets once they finish that. For now, they just have an outhouse. That's their shower. That's all the water they need. They're really well aware of water there for obvious reasons. This guy and he lived with his mom too. Oh, they were so nice. It was unbelievable. We got there late at night, and they had this whole spread of food out for us. We weren't even all that hungry, but we still ate some. The hospitality there was just absolutely incredible, and it really renewed or continued, I guess, my love of couch surfing and meeting new people in their homes, staying with them, and making new friends all around the world. I love doing it. If you've never couch surfed anywhere, I think it's worth a shot for the vast majority of travelers. And if you don't travel very much, you can always host people in your homes. We do that too, and it's almost like you're traveling yourself. You get to meet people and hear their stories of where they've been and how they got to your humble corner of the world. Anyway, I just love doing it. Can't recommend it enough. The next day, our host and his mom took us out for a little tour of the town. They had a car with the driver's wheel is on the right side of the car. And of course, in Russia, they drive on the right. So until this point, all the cars we had seen were like you'd see in America, like the driver's wheel is always on the left. But once we got around Lake Baikal, a lot of the time it was on the right, which is made for left countries where they drive on the left. So backwards. And I asked our host why this is, why there's so many right side driver cars here. And he was surprised I would even ask such a question. He said, well, these are Japanese cars. And in Japan, they drive on the left. Duh. And I pointed out that would actually be illegal, probably, in the United States. We have plenty of Japanese cars, but they switch the side of the driver's wheel. And he just kind of said, oh, that's weird. I wonder why they would do that. So cultural differences, folks. That's something you encounter all the time when you travel. Anyway, he took us to a bunch of places in the town. But the highlight, for sure, was going to this monastery, Tibetan Buddhist monastery, and we saw a bunch of the little temples, and these were pretty standard. We've seen a bunch of Tibetan Buddhist temples. There's a lot of etiquette that you have to follow. Obviously, no pictures inside. And one thing that we learned is you're supposed to walk out of these temples backwards. It's like you're playing Super Mario 3, and you want to keep looking at the ghosts so it never follows you. And so we'd always shuffle out of this thing, hoping we don't bump into anybody as we're walking backwards. And after seeing all of the little temples, we walked into the big one. There were a bunch of pews, and in the very back, there was this giant Buddha statue with blue hair staring at us. And there were like four or five monks sitting at these pews, and they were chanting really deep throaty style chant, and it just continued in this rhythm that I can't even do with my voice. I don't even know how much training they have to go through just to chant like this. And the people inside were getting really into it, they were, they all had covered their hair, we noticed. And some of them wore scarves or whatever. Some of them just put a jacket over their head. Katie threw her hood of her jacket over her head. I looked around, I was like, oh crap, I don't have anything. I can pull my shirt up, but then my belly will be exposed. Is that okay? And I don't know what the etiquette is. And I just kind of stood there like a dickhead, like hoping that no one would notice that I was disrespecting their culture so much. And these monks just kept, they were sitting cross-legged and chanting and rocking back and forth and going and going. And there was a bell ringing every few minutes. It was just really, really intense, this extreme religious experience for all of these people. And no one seemed to mind us being there, honestly. And it was so incredibly cool just to see this for a few minutes. And then after like 5 minutes of this chanting, they just stopped. And there was no clapping, no rituals I would expect in a church. Like nobody went up to take communion, nothing like that. Everybody just got up and started shuffling out of the building, and it was just done. It's like, wow, it's just so utterly different than any kind of religious experience I might have at home, that it's just fascinating to visit these Eastern cultures. Then we walked around the whole temple and looked at all the Buddhas and walked out backwards, shuffled out of this building, and we were back in the sunlight on the top of this giant hill overlooking the city, and it was all over. And we're like, wow, that was intense. The mom was going to make us dinner again, and we're like, oh man, we can't let you do that. We're already staying at your house, and you're making all the food for us. You're driving us around the town all day. How about this? We'll make dinner for you. And she said, right away she warmed up to it. She said, oh yeah, you should do that. How about you make some American food? I don't know what American food is. And Katie loves cooking, so this was a good challenge for her, but she didn't know what American food was either, really. So she started thinking about it and couldn't really come up with anything. So she actually Googled, what is American food? Like, is it cheeseburgers? Is it, well, pizza, I guess, is Italian food. Bratwurst, well, that's German. One suggestion among many was chili. And so she decided to cook chili for everybody, which was interesting because one of the main ingredients of chili, of course, is chili powder. And there was no chili powder in this town. No one makes chili there. So then she said, Googled, how do you make chili powder? And came up with like four or five spices. And she got all the ingredients and went back and cooked up this big chili. And Katie really, really pulled it off. It tasted just like American chili. It was awesome. And the family loved it. And there was extra food for them. And we shared a bottle of vodka to celebrate. It was awesome. I loved this this day, this couch surfing deal. And this was one of our best days in Russia and one of our last days in Russia. So we were grateful that we had stopped there. Our original plan was just to stop in Ulan-Ude for an hour or two and catch another train. Luckily, we decided to take a whole day and see the city. Anyway, after that, we made our final train journey into Mongolia, which Katie and I are going to talk about in the rest of the show. All right, I've been going on for about 18 minutes now. I want to just jump into our Russia in review. So let's get into my conversation with my guest and my wife, Katie Lipak, as we talk about our overall time in Russia. Well, Katie, welcome back to another show.
Thanks, Dan. I'm honored to be back on the show. I must have done really well in the Iceland episode.
Yes, you behaved well.
I get to come back on again.
Once in a blue moon.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, maybe
I guess
more.
You don't want it to kind of like a surprise then, right? Like people never just know when I'm going to be on the show.
Yes, it's mysterious that way.
All right.
Anyway, we're sitting here in our gear, and we are having a gear explosion in our gear here in Katskal, Mongolia.
Isn't it pronounced gear or is it gear?
I hear everybody who speaks it in English says gear, but then when I hear the Mongolians say it, it's like gear.
Okay. Yeah, it's always kind of one of those tricky things when you're going to a new place. Like, I don't really know how to pronounce anything, and then I feel like I'm butchering everything.
Yeah, but that's how you learn. You have to just try and say things. And
yeah.
You just keep saying it, and some people will correct you, hopefully.
Yeah, some people will.
The good ones do. Although, it's like, there's an art to it. If you hear someone speak in English, and it's broken and not very good, you don't want to criticize them too heavily.
Mm-hmm.
They might feel bad, but then, like, if you don't criticize them, then they'll never get that word right.
I guess it's kind of like when, when I'm teaching. Is that oftentimes when a kid say something that's grammatically incorrect, I'll just restate what they just said.
Oh, and say it in the right
time,
way.
Yeah. So, for example, if a kiddo says, my brother, she goes to school now. I'll say, oh, your brother, he went to school?
Ah, okay.
And I'll kind of put a little emphasis on it, and the kid will be like, yeah, he went to school.
Right, that's good. Now he doesn't feel bad about saying it wrong, and then...
Yeah, I just kind of get all excited about it, like, oh, he went to school? And the kid's like, oh, yeah.
Well, that works well when they're five.
That's true.
It's easy to fool a five-year-old.
But honestly, if somebody did that to me, I'd be like, thanks, man.
Yeah, that's how I usually am.
I'd be really open to that feedback. So hopefully people here will do that for us, and we'll eventually learn how to pronounce some Mongolian words. Because in Russia, I was doing the same thing. I was just butchering a bunch of words.
Yeah. Well, all I've learned how to say so far is hello, which is sambano. I guess we learned how to say wolf.
That's true. And sun.
And chun is, or something like that, is wolf. Sun is...
Nari.
Yeah, nar. Nari. E is good. Nari is sun is good.
I see.
Snow.
Is tusk.
Tusk, yeah. We had a lot of tusk in the last few
days. Mongolian words, yeah.
A lot of nar as well. And that's about all we know so far in Mongolian.
That's about all our guide knew or said to us.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, that'll be for another episode.
Yeah, we'll get to that later. It's just been such a whirlwind couple of weeks that I haven't even recorded an episode in a little while. The last few weeks has included coming into Mongolia from Russia and then getting deathly ill for a while, and that put me out of it. And then we did this crazy 5-day horseback riding and trek, which I'll talk about later. But today we are... here in our gear to talk about Russia. This will be our final episode discussing Russia. This is our roundup. We're going to just talk about
Russia in review.
Russia in review. Ah, I like it. I like the alliteration. And I've just kind of written a bunch of general topics to talk about that more or less cover our trip across Russia by train. And we're just going to go through the good, the bad, and the ugly of what we experienced. Maybe give some advice to people if they're looking to travel to Russia. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
All right, well, let's get to it. So the first thing I wrote down is entering the country. We entered Russia from Finland by train.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the map, Helsinki, Finland, and St. Petersburg, Russia are surprisingly close together. I didn't realize this.
And that was a quick train ride. I didn't really know how the immigration process was going to go. And that was pretty cool because we're just riding on this 4-hour high-speed train. And they did the immigration right there. They just walked through, checked papers as the train was moving.
Yeah, it was real smooth. We got stamped out of Finland or out of the Schengen zone.
Mm-hmm.
And made a stop in Russia. And a Russian official got on and just walked through and stamped everybody in. They asked where our baggage was. We pointed to our backpacks. No searching or anything like that.
Yeah, it was way, I don't know if you want to say more streamlined or efficient than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, totally.
I was expecting to like sit at the border while people checked every passenger one by one.
Right. I thought it would take a lot longer than it did. They have it down. I mean, they even have like the special train station in St. Petersburg. That's the Finland train station.
The train station that is from Finland goes to the Finlandia, pardon my butchering the pronunciation, Finlandia station or whatever, which is near the Lenin Square where Lenin gave the speech. Because I don't know if you remember this or not, but Lenin was hiding in part of Finland
Oh, okay.
During the Bolshevik time period when they were coming out. He was hiding there for a while. And he came in to St. Petersburg on that route, and he gave a famous speech from that train station.
Oh, okay.
On that square.
So it's named after him.
Well, the square across from the train station. The square,
right.
Yeah.
Although there's a Lenin Square, like, in every city in Russia. But I guess that's a
Lenin
special
something.
One.
Yeah. It's one of the things I learned from the few museums that I took up in St. Petersburg.
Yeah, anyway, the thing that actually more than anything surprised me is getting on that train. It we just hop. There's no security in Helsinki. We just hop on a train.
There was you no were a one little check... spooked out, actually. That was pretty funny.
There was
you
no
were, like,
one to check
looking around. This can't be right. We can't just get on this train and sit down. Like, there's got to be some, like, ticket check or inspection or something. And I'm like, you know, that's how it's been so far the whole time in Helsinki. It's just like you just get on the honor system.
Yeah, it's all honor system there. But I just thought, well, we're leaving the Schengen zone. We have to have our passports. There's got to be someone to just double check that we've actually got a ticket to this place.
That was pretty weird.
Like an hour later, we were in Russia. And like you could totally just accidentally get on this train and end up in Russia, get on the wrong train. Although obviously there's announcements like this train is going to Russia, but there's no one to double check is what I'm saying.
I think when you're used to traveling a lot and you're used to taking, you know, subways and trains and other things, especially in countries where they do check, you just get so accustomed to it. And then when you go to places like Finland or Germany where they do the honor system, it does kind of like take you back and you're like, what do I do? How does this work? Where do I go? Like, where's the check? How does this work? it just puts you back a little bit.
Yeah. Strange as this might sound, I actually don't like the honor system. And it's just because you just don't know if you did everything right. Like we lived in China. In Beijing, when you get on the subway, there are gates. And the gates only open once you put your ticket in. So once you're on the train, you know you're on. You haven't, like, violated any rules because you put your ticket in and the gate opened. There's no way someone could come on the train and say, well, you didn't buy a ticket or whatever.
Or got the wrong ticket.
Or got the wrong one. But in the European countries with the honor system, you could so easily just buy a ticket for the wrong zone or just not do something right. A lot of the machines don't even have English, or if they do, they're sometimes are really confusing. What do you do? And every now and then a guy just comes around and says, okay, show me your ticket. And it's really panicky for me because what if I have the wrong ticket? What if I did something wrong?
Yeah.
It's a giant fine. And it's like, God, I just feel like I got fooled into doing this. And all you had to do is put in a gate system. And then I would know 100% for sure that I did everything right.
That you paid.
I guess for locals, it's a lot more convenient to have the honor system. But for travelers, it's a little nerve-wracking, to be honest.
And when you are traveling a lot, it is one of those things, each time you go someplace new, you've got to learn, like, how does it work here? What is their system? You know,
yeah, it's
whatever.
A little different everywhere.
So we got on the train. That was pretty smooth. And even entering St. Petersburg was smooth. We were able to take public transportation right to our hostel.
Yeah, right away. The city did look, like, dreary and
it did.
Run
it's
down.
True.
But I think maybe looking back, that's because I expected it to look dreary and run down. I just expected Russia. Like, what I had in my head is, this is going to be Russia. It's going to be...
kind of like Soviet bloc kind of thing?
Yeah, it's going to be Soviet.
I do think that... I was talking to some couch surfers, both in St. Petersburg, and we went to the event in Moscow. And the couch surfer in Moscow said that he... this is, of course, his opinion. He's a Moscow guy, so he probably thinks, you know, highly of his own city compared to St. Petersburg. But he said that, you know, St. Petersburg is really grand and amazing in the center part of it. Then outside of that, sort of main, central, I don't know if you want to say touristy, but that part, it's drearier and more run down than Russia, than Moscow is. So Moscow also, of course, looks really great around the Red Square and at the whole area around there. It's nicer, but then as you go further out, he said it's less drab, less rundown. It's not quite a drastic transition, I guess, is what he was trying to say.
Yeah, that makes sense. And of course, as soon as we start recording this, some guy starts up a chainsaw and starts cutting wood in the background.
Ah, well, that's the they're getting ready for winter here. A big load of wood was just delivered to this gear camp today, and they've got to cut enough wood for the whole, 10-month winter?
It's true. It's their only way of heating here.
It's September.
Is burning wood.
And it's already winter.
Yo, yeah, you totally need to have your stove going now. I mean, it's dropping below zero Celsius every night, for sure. Even during the day, sometimes.
We'll have to just try to ignore that noise and just continue.
All right, well, yeah, we don't have a lot of spare time to pause this, and let's just hope it ends, or I'm sorry, folks who are listening, if that's really bothering you. Anyway, the first thing we did in St. Petersburg was take the subway.
Yep.
And it was... it took a few minutes to figure out how to do it. But again, there's no honor system there. So once we're on, we're good.
Yep.
And what was your first impression of the subway?
That was so strange. Just because going down those... It's the Russian subway system is the deepest that I've ever experienced anywhere in the world. And as we're going down those long escalators that some of them literally take 3 to 5 minutes to go down them. You just keep going down and down and down. And that's exactly what we experienced when we were in North Korea. So it was such a weird feeling to get on the subway in St. Petersburg and feel like, hey, I've done this before. And my brain is kind of searching through the file folders of where have I done this before? Why does this feel familiar? And then looking for that reasoning, and I was like, oh, it's like North Korea. And it's odd. It's just odd to compare something to, oh, yeah, like that one time I was in North Korea.
Yeah, it looks just like Pyongyang. The lighting between the escalators, the really deep escalators, the way there's this big old tunnel that's just painted bright white.
Yeah.
Soothing music in the background sometimes.
And then it's just your brain kicks in the understanding and the logic comes afterwards. You're like, that's right. It's because Russians built the subway system in Pyongyang. They basically were the ones who funded all those projects.
Right. And, of course, the reason these subways are so deep is they double as bomb shelters.
Right.
I mean, these were built during the Cold War.
Right.
But it's comically deep.
Weird.
You just start laughing after a few minutes on the escalator. Is this thing ever going to end? One time in Russia, I think in Moscow, we got on the wrong escalator.
You did. Oh. You got on the wrong escalator. And I was standing at the top being like, where are you going? I'm like, damn it. So if I didn't know what to do, if I let you go all the way down in the bottom and then you were just waiting and waiting and waiting for me, I couldn't really be sure that you would get the message that I didn't get on. So I'm like, oh, I'll get on. Okay. So I went down all the way down. And I said, damn, we're on the wrong one. There's two different lines, went down two different escalators. Right. Line 5 over here, line 3 over here. And then you're like, what? And so we went all the way back up.
It's 5 minutes down, 5 minutes back up, then 5 minutes down the right one.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
So don't ever get on the wrong one.
And also we kind of found out that it wasn't really worth... I mean, this is true for a lot of places. But, you're kind of walking long distances in bigger cities. Oftentimes, and so we're like, oh, we'll just hit the subway. It's one stop. But that was stupid. It's really stupid there because it feels like in places where you've got long escalators or long transfers, it's just better to just walk 15, 20 minutes. Because you spend 10 minutes getting there, you know?
Yeah, and on top of that, the signage was lacking, or English signage was lacking. It was almost all written in Russian.
It was just a different system as well that we're used to. So
yeah.
It took a little bit to figure it out.
I'd say it was much easier in Beijing to use the subway than in Moscow or St. Petersburg. But beautiful. Yeah. The subways were beautiful.
True.
And cheap. Anyway, let's move on. Next up is the museums in St. Petersburg. What did you think of that?
I mean, I think both St. Petersburg and Moscow just have so many museums. And in St. Petersburg, I'm going to admit, it wasn't, the focus of that trip was not to go hiking in the forest, you know? And so it's kind of like, well, we're in this city and it's, I'm here to experience culture and I'm here to learn history. And I'm really interested in learning more about Russian history, and so are you. And so it's just one of those things that I actually felt a little bit overwhelmed. Like, oh my gosh, we have 4 days. And mentally and physically, I felt like going to museums was almost more exhausting than backpacking for a day.
Because, it's draining. Yeah.
Because you walk there, you go into the museum, and you spend like 2 to 4 hours walking around learning stuff. And your brain is like starting to get kind of fried, and your feet kind of hurt from standing on like hard floors all day. And, you know, and so that's one of those things that I just don't usually go to that many museums in a 4 day span. But in St. Petersburg, there were a bunch I wanted to go to. They had quirky museums. They had great art museums. They had great history museums.
We didn't even go to the Hermitage, did you?
No, I didn't. I went to I'm blanking on all the names of the museums I went to now.
The one art museum. The Art Museum of Russia something?
Yeah, the Russian Art Museum. and I went to the Political History Museum, which I thought was really cool. It was well curated. There wasn't a lot of English, and then midway through I figured out that each section had a booklet. And in the booklet, each caption was written in English in the booklet. So you had to like go to the little tray, pick up the English booklet, and then read all the captions. And then I learned a lot more. But that was cool because, I mean, let's be real here. Russian history and politics has been pretty dramatic.
God, yeah.
So that museum was pretty cool for me. And then I also went to the ethnography museum where they had all the skulls. And the
human skulls?
Yeah, they had Peter the Great had studied in Amsterdam, and he was really interested in all kinds of topics like medicine and everything else. And he had brought back they had started collecting different feces and different things to study for medical purposes.
Oh yeah.
And they saved them all, and it was just like a really interesting ethnography museum. And then all these like human fetuses, that was like the main attraction. Everybody was lined up. I think I waited in line for like an hour to get in that museum, hour and a half. And it was kind of like the Russian experience of queuing.
Yeah, that could be a whole topic in and of itself. How the lines there are just epic. It's so not China. It's just so different. Like everybody lines up.
They love lining up.
And they love it. Sometimes they don't even know what they're in line for.
They just see a line and they say like, oh, there's a line. Let's go find out what the line is for.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that is, it's you know.
But on that topic, I do remember I just finished a book about the Romanovs, which was like so dramatic and so interesting. But one thing I just remembered is Peter the Great had maybe a mistress of his executed, had her head cut off. And just impromptu, he just picked up her head and started showing the crowd like, okay, and here's where all the veins and arteries come in and out. And this is the windpipe. And right in here, you're going to have the brains. And just gave like this science lecture.
Yeah, he was, I think he'd be another interesting person to read more about because he really did. He came into St. Petersburg and had all these grand ideas of designing the city. And he really wanted it to be a place of learning and medical study and the architecture and the canals and the art. He wanted it to be a place of culture and art.
Well, he had that side of him, but then he, like I just said, he had his mistress's head cut off. And then I think it was his mistress, and he ordered the execution of his own son, an heir to the throne.
Right, yeah.
And it's like just because his son was a pussy or something. Like his son didn't want to do it, you know?
Didn't want to be the next guy to
He's like, fine, cut off your head. I think the son conveniently died before they were able to execute him. But
yeah.
Interesting.
You really could just go to St. Petersburg for like 2 weeks and just do museums. It really could be like, even the Hermitage itself, people can go there for like 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
And go to all the parts of it.
What about the architecture outside? That's the next thing on our list.
I mean, I thought it was just so, it felt to me so much like I was taking a step back in time. And again, it's in that center part of the city. And we stayed in a place that was centrally located really close to all the museums there. And, you know, we did go to a couch surfing event that was further out that was drearier and more run down, but in that center part, it is just grand.
Yeah, that's the one word you can use to describe it.
I mean, the buildings just have these big, huge blocks. You can tell that each floor is just super tall, and it's just...
I mean, you'd have a four-story building that's like 80 feet tall, 100 feet tall.
You'd have to walk around all these things. So it kind of feels like, dang, I got to walk around this huge building that's taken up like blocks. You know, and it's all the decal on all the tops of it and all the columns is just immaculate. It's amazing.
Oh, it's just beautiful. Truly beautiful, stunning city. I mean, like, you really should be comparing it with Paris, I think.
Unfortunately, it rained every day there, so we just felt like so worn out from all the walking around in the rain. But whatever, it was beautiful, and I really enjoyed it. And I think that other people have said this to me, a few others have said this, that St. Petersburg just doesn't get the credit as a great city that it deserves. And I agree. And after being there for a few days, I agree with that comment.
Yeah, it's same here, totally.
I think the setback is just that the visa to get to Russia is harder. You can't just like, hey, I'm going to fly to Amsterdam. I'm going to fly over to Paris, you know. Getting a visa for Russia is a little bit trickier. But one tip that we have is that if you are going to go to, if you want to just go to St. Petersburg, is that you can go to Finland and take a ferry. Well, how did that work?
You take a ferry from Helsinki into St. Petersburg. It's an overnight ferry. And then you can stay in Russia for up to 72 hours without a visa. But you have to take a ferry in, and you have to take the same ferry back out.
Okay, I see.
And as long as you do that, you don't need to obtain a visa beforehand.
So and that can save you like $150, whatever it was for the visa. I don't remember what it was.
Yeah, the visa's kind of expensive. And I mean, it wasn't like really hard to get. It just was a little bit time consuming.
Right.
With current relations, it's getting a little harder, though. Not that it's hard to get. It's just they've closed all of the consulates in both countries other than the main embassy. And this is more of an issue for Russians wanting to come to the States to travel.
Yeah, we learned that. Like, that was really interesting for me, actually. You know, before coming on the trip, and you talked about this in your other podcast, about people are like, oh, man, why are you going to Russia? Like, be safe, be careful, you know, the police do bribes, the people are kind of rough, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, one of the things that we learned from talking to people, like people who did speak English well, is that it's hard for them to come to the U.S. They can't just go to their nearest consulate because they've all been closed down. If they live out in Ulan-Ude or
Vladivostok,
like any of those places, they have to go to Moscow, which is days on the train, or it can be an expensive flight. So in addition to paying for their visa, they've got to pay for a flight to Moscow, pay for a place to stay, and do all of that just to get a visa to come to the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, Russia is huge. Obviously, Russia's a big country. But imagine you live in Los Angeles, and you have to go not just to New York, but like to New York and then down to Miami, but all by train, or take like an 8-hour flight.
Yeah.
And that's just to get to the embassy, whereas you used to be able to just walk over to your local consulate, which has now been closed. It's just, it's a frustrating thing with being a traveler for me, is I'm not into politics. I'm not in the government. Neither are most travelers. We just want to go see another country.
Yeah.
And because our governments are having a fight now, and they're just like snipping at each other, now we have to pay the price.
Yeah.
That it's harder to go travel.
And that, you know, especially for, we met this really great older couple as we're hiking into the Stobie Nature Reserve outside of Krasnoyarsk. And their daughter lives in the U.S. And they were talking about their trip to the U.S. And they want to go back and see their daughter. But now, next time they want to go visit their child, they've got to travel 4 days by train or fly to Moscow in order to do that.
Yeah.
They've got to make tons of preparations to do that. And so that's one of the things that I think, you know, myself included, a lot of Americans take for granted, that so far, it's been pretty easy for us to go to a lot of countries with our passport.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we still... I mean, look, there's tensions in various countries and there's problems here and there, but the American passport is definitely one of the best ones in terms of accessibility to the world's countries. I mean, I think we can go to like 180 countries, something, I forget the exact number, something like that, without a visa, or you just have to buy a visa in the airport when you get there. So it's quite easy for us to travel just about anywhere in the world. Which is a great privilege that we have that most people in the world do not have. Anyway, let's move on. Let's talk about after St. Petersburg, we took a train down to Moscow that was overnight. And the one thing I wrote down to talk about is Moscow time. And this was just a little bit of a frustration with us, just a confusion, is that all the train schedules in Russia, when you buy your tickets, when you go to the train station, all the times are written as Moscow time. At this point in our trip, we were still on Moscow time, so it wasn't an issue. But as we moved further from Moscow, it became this adding and subtracting game. So once we got down to Lake Baikal, we were 6 hours ahead of Moscow, because again, Russia is huge. There's many time zones.
Yeah, our train said that we left at like 10 and really were leaving at like 2.
Right. So actually, when I bought one of our train tickets, I thought we were going to be on the train from 9 till 5.
Like, right.
Great. All day we get to sit on the train and watch the scenery. Whoops. I forgot about the Moscow time thing.
Right.
And now, it was only 4 hours, but still it was like get on the train at 1 in the afternoon instead of 9.
Yeah, I guess it's one of those things like, to be fair, they have a system. And you know what? It's better to be somewhere traveling where there's a system. You just got to learn the system. And it's just one of those things that you're always like double and triple checking to make sure it's the time right. It's the time right. Did we get it right? Is it 10 o'clock or is it 4 o'clock? Is it 10 o'clock or is it 2 o'clock?
Like,
you're just constantly making sure. And, you know, one time we did actually add the wrong direction. We got to the train station a couple hours early, and we're like, oh, duh, we went the wrong direction in time.
Right, and I talked about this before, but that's a good point, is that if you screw up, as long as you're going east and not west, you're going to screw up in the right direction, so you'll get there really early.
Right.
But you're going to double whatever the time difference is. So if you accidentally subtract 2 hours instead of adding, now it's 4 hours. So we got to the train station 4 hours early.
Yeah.
Or actually 5 hours, because we were planning to get there an hour early anyway.
Yeah, we had plenty of time to read that day.
Yeah, I guess if you're going the other direction, though, if you're going west to east, you could miss your train very easily. So you gotta always keep an eye on that. And it's especially important, like, we bought our tickets from the States, and so we weren't even aware of this time thing.
I had read it in the guidebook, but I think when you kind of did the booking, and we didn't really even talk about it really, so... Anyways, the good thing is they have a system. Bad thing is that you just got to be constantly double and triple checking your time, because it's just a little bit confusing.
Right. Right. So the next topic to talk about were the markets and the supermarkets and the food.
I mean, I guess this is one of those things that I think for me, mentally, I prepared myself. My first time traveling for a year, I prepared myself to be thinking of this traveling for a year as a job. And I'm not just, I'm not on holiday where I'm going to eat out every night and I'm going to, you know, constantly be doing that. And just like at home, I'm thinking about it as I'm at home, we would eat out maybe 2 times a week. In Beijing, more, maybe 3 or 4. But so that's the same thing for traveling. It's kind of keep up that same way of life. And that means we need to go shopping for food more often, and we need to buy food. And the benefit to that is that every single guest house or hostel we stayed at in Russia had a kitchen, and that was amazing for me, because I could go to the store, and if I could find whatever I could find, I could cook dinner for us, or I could make food for us on the train. So that was a definite plus was that every guest house or hostel had a kitchen. But the downside was that, you know, when you're traveling, you've got to find all these markets, right? So you've got to, like, be like, okay, where's the market? Where's the supermarket? And so some of the supermarkets were pretty decent. The ones in Irkutsk were really, really nice, actually. And they had quite a good variety of stuff. I was impressed. But some of the other cities, I found, like, the vegetables were kind of minimal. And or, I'm forgetting exactly which city it was. It might have been Yekaterinburg or Krasnoyarsk. I think it was Krasnoyarsk. It was like, I was finding moldy tomatoes and just, like, mushy peppers and really low-quality vegetables. And it's just frustrating because I want to eat vegetables every day. And I want to plan for that. And so that was kind of hard for me to do. And so we're doing a lot of hiking and camping in the middle part of our trip after we left Moscow and St. Petersburg. And so it's just easy to just get bread and cheese and make sandwiches every day. And so there are supermarkets that have the bigger stores. But then there's also these little corner markets, I guess it's the best way to call it. It's just a little drink shop. And you go into this little drink shop, and inside the drink shop, everything is behind the counter. And that was so frustrating for me. So I remember being in Suzdal, and like a little old granny would go in before me. And she'd be in there telling the lady behind the counter, I want this, and I want that, and I want this. And you're waiting outside or whatever. And I just want to, like, get a few things, you know? And now the granny's done. Now I've got to go on Google and type in oatmeal and show the lady oatmeal. Well, meanwhile, another granny comes in, and she's all like, this, do, 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 do. And then I'm like, okay, wait for the next granny to finish. So it's just super frustrating that I had to type in, like, oatmeal, show the lady, like, Google Translate. The benefit was that Google Translate worked.
Well, that's good.
You know, like, Google works there. And then type in tea. Well, there's, like, 40 types of tea on the shelf. And I've got to, like, kind of try to point from across the counter which tea I want. Do I want this green tea or that green tea or this fruit tea or that fruit tea or this black tea? And, like, kind of go through this thing. And so it just was so frustrating that I couldn't just walk into a shop and be like, grab all the things I need and go to the counter.
Yeah. Actually, I just thought of this. You should have just brought your trekking pole in.
Oh,
and extend it all the way, and then just, like, poke whatever you want. Just reach over the counter, dink, dink, dink.
Life hack.
Yeah, there you go.
That would have been a life hack, if only we would have thought of it sooner.
Yeah.
Well, now I know. If I'm traveling and I see this again, I'm just going to go shopping with my trekking pole, and hopefully no security guards will tackle me.
Hopefully not. Or old ladies.
Or old ladies, you know.
Well, you could also use the thing longerer, which is a Futurama reference.
All right. You've got all your references.
Yeah.
So the other thing about these little shops that was so frustrating, in addition to, like, it just taking forever, because it's not just me that has to do this, but every single customer. There's one lady behind the counter. So every customer has got to tell her all 5 things they want or 10 things they want.
Yeah, you can't begin shopping until you get to the front of the line.
And then she's got to run around the counter and get everything for you. And usually people are just wanting, like, a bottle of vodka or, like, a little bit of fish or a little bit of meat or a little bit of oatmeal or whatever, you know. But anyway, so the other frustrating thing was the all the water coolers or the refrigerators that had all the bottled drinks, they were all locked. And so in the beginning, it was like, you know, you yank on it, and it's like, it's locked. You can't open it. And you're like, hey, why is this thing locked? And then everybody in the shop starts looking at you like, why are you attacking the machine? And then you're like, hey, you know. Finally, you know, learn just to buzz them open.
Yeah.
And so they buzz it open, and then you're like, oh, okay, I want this one. Well, then, like, I also wanted a drink in the other one. So let's say one of them had, like, water. Well, I also wanted to get beer, so now I needed to buzz open that one. And so while she's waiting on the other customers and getting all their 10 things, I've got to be like, hey, yo, can you buzz this one open too? And I don't know if that's just because of crime, like if it's like a theft thing, or yeah, I'm not sure.
It didn't seem like it, because there are some places with supermarkets, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of security there or cameras everywhere.
I think in Moscow it was more of an issue where people were buying alcohol and like they maybe were like stealing alcohol and stuff like that. But like in these other small places, it just kind of seemed like they just kept the system going. I'm not really sure. I'm not from there.
I don't know either.
It was frustrating.
I don't know either. It just seemed like something that they've always done. Like, well, we've always done it this way, so let's continue.
Yeah,
like,
we did it
back in Soviet times. It must still work.
I don't know, but it was frustrating. It was frustrating to just, like, this thing of which going into a corner shop should have taken me 2 minutes. Now it's taking me all this time.
Yeah, and it's definitely totally fine if you're Russian. I mean, because you know the system, you know the language.
That's right.
You don't need a thing longer. You can just say it. But mm-hmm. for foreigners, it's just a tough one.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough ranting about that. Let's talk about, I guess, Moscow. We didn't really spend a lot of time there, and I already talked about it a little bit, but
I think when we were there, we kind of had things to take care of. We needed to go pick up our train tickets. We needed to do a few things. We had an agenda. You needed to go see the Lenin Mausoleum, which guys, I mean, I know Dan already talked about this, but that was pretty cute. Dan was like a 5-year-old who just left the candy store after he was like had accomplished seeing all the dead communist leaders. It was pretty funny.
Yes, I got to see Lenin.
So, but I mean, it was cool that that day we stumbled upon that horse show. That was really cool. You know, Moscow, it's one of those things, like, it was underneath tons of construction, and it almost kind of made me think about one of the Russians said, like, yeah, it's construction season, and it's kind of the same, I guess, for a lot of places that have long winters, is that they've only got this short period of time to do all the fixing of the sidewalks and the buildings and stuff.
Yeah, well, so we say in Wisconsin, Wisconsin only has two seasons, winter and road construction.
Yeah.
But the thing I think most people don't realize is they say that everywhere.
Everywhere, like, that has winter?
Yeah. Like, you think that's your unique expression? No, it's not. Or, like, the mosquito is our state bird. Like, they also say that everywhere. Things like that.
Yeah. Like, Finland and Russia, they all have bad mosquitoes.
Or if you don't like the weather, just wait a few minutes and it'll change. Or, like, we can experience all four seasons in one day here.
Right.
Yeah, like, half the states say that stuff. It's not unique to your state. Anyway, let's move on.
Yeah.
The big thing that we had to do, though, in Moscow, or we thought we had to do, was the registration thing. We should talk about that a little bit.
This was one of those things that was super confusing. So, apparently, before, I believe, and I don't have all the details for this, so please don't hate me if I say this wrong, but before, you needed to register at every city you went to and every hotel.
During the Soviet Union.
Yeah. And so now you don't have to do that anymore. But we were under the impression from things we had read on websites and from other places and that you had to register within 7 days of entering the country. And you had to register if you stayed and you were longer than 7 days. That's what we had thought.
Well, and it's not like we just read this on some random blog. Literally every website I checked said the same thing. Right. And these are official travel agencies, including the travel agency that we bought our tickets to Russia through.
Right.
Their website says this. You must register within 7 days of entering the country.
And so the first place in St. Petersburg, they just said, like, nah, you can't do it here. We can't do it for you. But somebody else we met, staying in a different place, they did register her. So we were confused about that. And then she said, well, you just need to go to Moscow and do it. Well, we were couch surfing in Moscow, so that was just kind of a mess. And the agency, I contacted them, and they just said, like, no, you don't need to register. You'll be fine.
But again, their own website says that you do.
Yeah.
So we're just confused.
Right.
And these websites all say you will face severe consequences when you leave the country if you don't have the right paperwork.
And this is one of those things where, you know, you don't know, like, you hear about, you know, police and other officials charging you a bribe to kind of, like, look the other way. And we really didn't want to do that. And we're trying to kind of cross all of our T's and dot all of our I's to make sure we didn't have to do that. But it's really hard when you can't figure out, like, how to cross the T and dot the I. You can't figure out how to do it. And that was what was the frustrating part, was that maybe, and I think you said you read one thing that said maybe things have changed recently and now nobody actually knows what the rules are.
Right. Or if I think I read one, just one message forum that, well, when the government translates their official stuff into English, it definitely says you must register within 7 days of entering the country. But the original Russian is more ambiguous than that. Mm. So it's not even really clear what you need to do. Anyway, we just wanted to be careful. So we ended up going to a hostel and just asking them if they could register us, even though we weren't staying there. This apparently people do this sometimes.
Yeah, and we got it. And it worked out. It just took time.
It took a while. It cost a bit of money. It did work out, and we had that peace of mind.
That's true.
But just to skip ahead a little bit, when we left the country, I was like, okay, now are they actually going to ask for this paper? And
It was
one of those, like, I want you to ask for it, damn it, because I paid money to get this thing. And no, they didn't ask for it at all. We totally could have just not done it.
And this is one of those things where you and I are a little bit different, like, in a good way. I think, you know, we balance each other in that way. Like, you're a bit more paranoid about these things. And I, after the agency wrote back, I was like, the agent said it's okay. Let's just, you know. And you're like, no, let's just take care of this, you know.
Well, you know, we can pay $15 now and just get it done, or risk having a $1,000 fine and a couple days in jail. Like, let's...
Or
maybe getting banned from the country, from entering the country for 5 years. You know, that's the other consequence.
Yeah. So, anyways, it worked out, but it was super confusing, and it wasted our time in Moscow. We could have been doing other things in Moscow had we clearly known what to do.
Yeah.
But
we already kind of didn't want to spend too much time in Moscow because we wanted to see the other places along the route, and I guess just the one thing we can say in general here is we only got 30 days on our visas. That's all you get when you get a tourist visa.
Right.
And it, again, it's the biggest country in the world. You can't possibly see everything in 30 days. So we had to pick and choose what to do. And Moscow just ended up only getting the very basics, the Red Square, the seeing Lenin.
Right.
That's about all we did there.
We did a walking tour.
We did a couple things. But,
it's true. And I guess... it seems like, you only have 30 days in Russia. But then again, think about it in terms of coming to the U.S. and kind of try to compare it, I guess, is that trying to see the U.S. in 30 days also would be...
also impossible.
...really difficult, you know? And so I guess, you know, the focus of this trip was the Trans-Siberian for us, and it was also to see nature. And so St. Petersburg and Moscow, we also didn't want to give them the shaft. We wanted to give them a few days to see it. But it wasn't our total focus, really.
All right, so I just have a couple more notes on that area. One is the language barrier, which we found out was very real.
I think in St. Petersburg and Moscow, it really wasn't a problem. Like, when I went to museums and stuff, like, it was okay to... find someone to say something or whatever, not as bad. But as soon as we left Moscow, it was real.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing is we came from, well, we spent a few days in Iceland, and everybody in Iceland speaks English. We spent a while in Finland. Just about everybody in Finland speaks English, and not just, like, kind of speaks it, like, speaks it at the same level as us.
Yeah.
Then as soon as we got to Russia, it's like, oh, well... now you know what, we're though? Now not so many.
The kind of cool thing about traveling in a place where it is difficult, like, I think it's something that, unfortunately, I think this is the thing that stops people from traveling. I think people get really nervous about going to a place where they can't speak English. But I don't think that should ever stop you. I think that people underestimate the power of the nonverbal communication. And we've seen this in several situations where we've met people. And, of course, you're not having, like, a highly academic conversation or a political conversation or anything, like, in depth. But, like, the guy we met on the train, Nikolai, like, we kind of got the gist down. Like, we knew where he was from. He knew where we were from. We knew that he liked vodka. We communicated a few things, you know?
What more do you need?
Like, yeah. And I think you kind of forget, like, you actually, and like the lady in Suzdal, holy cow, she was good. There was this guest house we stayed at in Suzdal, this little village on the Golden Ring, and she could basically communicate the whole thing of like, okay, so, you know, you go out, like, to the market, come back, knock on my door, say, Helena, and then Helena comes down the stairs, and you give me the key, and you get your backpack, and you leave, and you go to the train station. She pretty much said all of that through miming and gesturing. And it really made me think about that one improv game. You know, we've got a lot of friends who do improv, yeah. And they do that game where they pretend they're in the grocery store. And person, so there's the person who works in the grocery store who has to guess what the other person is trying to say, or what they want, right? And the audience or other people write down what they're trying to get, like unicorn goldfish crackers, something like that. So now the guy has to say in gibberish what he wants, and the shopkeeper's got to guess it. And that made me think a lot about, like, man, improv people could do a really good job traveling. They could be really good at this, like, kind of thing.
That's true. If you play that game in improv, you can travel anywhere if you're pretty good at it.
Yeah, so you just kind of act out all the parts, and then once they get parts of the word, and they put it all together and be like, yeah, oh, you want unicorn goldfish crackers.
Yeah.
Duh. It's right here on the shelf.
I mean, this doesn't happen often, but some regions of the world, like I was in India, and I found that Hindi, I don't know a word of Hindi. I don't know any of it. But when I hear people speaking Hindi, they'll throw in some English words here and there.
Oh, right.
And those tend to be the important words. So I just hear, like, blah, 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 unicorn, blah, 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 fish, blah, 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 crackers. And now I know that's unicorn fish crackers.
Yeah. Like,
or whatever you said. And
I mean, the point of that game is to make up the most ridiculous phrase of something you could ask for so that it makes it funnier. But it's just the same.
But even sometimes here in Mongolia, like, I don't know any Mongolian other than the few words we said, but I'll just hear a couple of things that sound similar to English, like they've just borrowed these words, and I can sometimes pick up the gist of what they're talking about without knowing anything. And a lot of it's just, like, looking at their visual cues. But
yeah,
anyway,
I think so.
The point is just don't let that stop you from traveling.
Yeah, don't let it stop you. And, like, people really hold a lot in their nonverbal cues and their gestures. I mean, some don't, and then it's a lot harder to communicate. But, and maybe I just maybe notice this a bit more because of my hearing loss. Maybe because that I've had to use those cues so much in my life. And I notice them a lot when I travel with people I'm trying to communicate with.
Yeah, and just when you are a traveler, you just learn to do this naturally, too.
Yeah, but we pretty much, I think there was two things that were kind of a little bit, not surprising. I wasn't surprised with the language barrier. It didn't surprise me, but it was, you know, I guess after you left Moscow, it was pretty limited. But one thing that did kind of surprise me was we really didn't see that many other travelers. We saw no Americans at all in Russia.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Not one American.
Well, we met that brother and sister. They were half American, half Russian.
They were half American.
But they really were.
They were, like, living there pretty much.
Yeah, they were integrated within Russian culture.
And we really didn't see that many, like, other backpackers from other countries either. It's mostly just, like, a few Russians staying in those places. Probably the most, we've met the most Swiss travelers in Mongolia and in Russia so far.
Huh.
But really haven't, like, we went through a couple of stretches where we didn't talk to anybody else but each other.
Yeah, how boring is that?
It's not too bad. I have to say it's not too bad. It's going better than I thought. I did kind of think, like, that was going to be one of the hard things about traveling for years. Like, dang, man, I'm used to going to work for, like, 10 hours a day. I'm used to seeing all these people and talking to numerous people all the time. And now I'm stuck with my husband for, like, 24 hours a day. And he's going to be the only person that I'm talking to. And in parts of Russia, you were the only person that I really talked to for quite a long time. But you know what? It's all right. So I think we're going to make it.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. All right. Well, speaking of the people, and, I mean, we talked about language barrier, but what about just how were the people in general in Russia?
Yeah, you know, the people that, you know, that we met did speak English. And, of course, This is also like a small scale sample, of course, because, you know, we only could really talk to people we spoke English to. But even the ones who didn't really speak English, they all wanted to help us.
Yeah, well, not all, but a lot.
Generally speaking, you know, most people on the streets, you know, they don't, like, smile at you and say hi to you. They're not, like, the Midwestern charm friendly on the street. They kind of just go about their business and pass along. We expected that, you know. But a lot of people that, as we're traveling, you know, if we needed something, they worked hard to try to figure out how they could help us. Like, that one day in Moscow when we went to that really nice little market in that neighborhood, and we were going to cook dinner for our couch surfer, and we thought, oh, let's make, like, some gram masala spices.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He put that whole thing together for us, and they, like, looked it up in Russian. We translated it, looked it up in Russian. He went and put, like, all those spices in a packet, and I felt like I was starting to get kind of impatient, like, oh, forget about it. But, like, you were so patient, and he was so patient, and
the other
shopkeeper really wanted to help us. And that was just so sweet. And
well, at first I was like, okay, we go to a spice market, and there's all these spices. And so what does Katie ask for? Cumin? No. Mint? No. Gran masala. Oh, God.
Well, I just thought that he had so many spices. Maybe he already had one mixed up, you know? I didn't necessarily need that one. But then once I said it, nobody was letting it go.
Oh, they were on a mission.
Like,
they
once
needed
I said it,
thing.
I could have just gone back and been like, just give me cumin. That would have been fine for me. And then once we said it, they were determined to make exactly what,
yeah,
you know.
But they did it.
And there are several other examples, too, where things happened or people just, like, shared things with us or, like, hikers they met. And other people were just really, really friendly. And they, you know, they were helpful. And I really appreciated that. And I have to remind myself again and again that most people in this world are good.
Yeah.
And that we just tend to let the media... You know, I'm not saying that you shouldn't be cautious, because you should be cautious. And there are certain places in the world where you need to be more cautious. And I'm not saying you shouldn't be careful, because you do need to be safe and you need to be careful. But also, just be open to letting people show you their goodness, you know?
Well, you have to. I mean, when you travel, you're vulnerable, and you have to make yourself vulnerable. Like, you don't know the language. You can't read the signs. You just need help all the time,
yeah,
for the most basic things. You have to rely on the kindness of strangers, but luckily they come through.
Yeah, it's true that.
It's definitely a big lesson in travel. And yeah, it's something I'll probably talk about over and over and over, but it's...
You should talk about the both places we were hiking. In Stobie, we met two people in Stobie that really were like... I think our conversations there were just like... we met this older couple, and they basically said, like, it doesn't matter about our politics. It doesn't matter about all of that. Like, here in the forest, people are just want peace.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they talked about how in Russia they also have propaganda against the United States. And so it goes both ways.
Right. And, I mean, anywhere you go in the world, when people find out that you're not from there, the first thing they're going to ask you always is, where are you from?
Mm-hmm.
It's the most natural question ever. And, of course, a lot of Americans, if they've never been anywhere, are like, well, you got to tell people you're from Canada, right? Like, you got to say you're Canadian, because no one hates Canadians. Like, oh, it's so stupid. I don't think anyone actually does this. I hope not. Like, if you do, please stop. But I've never done that. And so I always say, I always tell the truth. I'm American. And so, again, if you haven't ever traveled anywhere, you might think the next thing that comes out of people's mouths is, oh, I hate you, you're such a horrible person. But, like, that's never the next thing out of their mouth. What do they say? Oh, well, I have a cousin in New York. Or, oh, I really want to travel to your country. Or I used to live there. Or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's always something nice. And it's like... nothing to be ashamed of, like, where you're from. Like, if you're going to hate me because of where I was born...
or because of who our president is...
or any of that stuff, know. Like, then I really don't have time to talk to you,
yeah,
you know? And,
I mean, actually, I had a lot of that when I was traveling in Scotland, and Bush just got elected. I was there in in 2001. And, like, everybody had tons of questions about Bush. And all these questions about, like, do Americans like him? Like, what do they think about him? And, like, all this stuff, you know? And it was just... It
but just, are they hating you because
no,
of,
like... No, not at all. They're just curious. They're kind of, like... And it was fascinating that they knew so much about our country, you know? Like, people follow American politics. And sometimes they want to know what you think. And other times they're just like... Let's just not even go there. And both people we met in Stobie that we talked to and hiked with for a while, they're both just like, let's just not go there. Let's just think about, you know, like, we both love nature. This is a peaceful place, and let's appreciate each other, you know, which is cool.
Yeah. And I mean, when you're face-to-face with another person, you're just people.
Mm-hmm.
You're just talking. That's all it is. When you don't travel anywhere, you have this abstract idea of what these people are like, and that idea tends to come from media, and the media is negative, and no one's ever going to report that, like, oh, Katie and Dan went to Russia for a month, and they had fun. It was a good trip. Nothing bad happened to them.
Right.
They weren't kidnapped. Nothing got stolen. Nothing. Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
that's not a story. That's not a media story. I mean, it's on my podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And you should definitely listen to my podcast, but it's not going to get on CNN or anything like that. Of course, bad stuff will get on, but that's a tiny percentage of the people who travel. All right, enough of that topic. Let's move on. I think we've covered most of the stuff that we wanted to talk about. Let's talk about the just being outside, though, and camping in general. Probably our biggest goal in Russia was just to get outdoors, because before this we were living in Beijing, and we love Beijing, but it's a giant city of 20 plus million people. And
we love China for a lot of reasons, but you know, nature there was a little different than our viewpoint of how you interact with nature. And in Russia it was really great. Like, the nature was amazing. And I would say that the one kind of, I guess, surprising, or maybe I just am naive and didn't do enough research, but I knew that the Ural Mountains ran north-south, and Yekaterinburg was the closest city, or one of the bigger cities to stop and to go there, but it's really not that close. And later afterwards, when I was doing research, you know, of course I'm doing research like a few days before we're going to go there, the Russians are like, yeah, it's not that close. And all these travelers come here thinking, like, we're just going to go hop off and go to the Ural Mountains. It's not a hop off.
Yeah, we got off the train. We're like, this looks pretty flat for the mountains.
Yeah, so then
there's like that scene in Dumb and Dumber. Like, oh, the Rockies don't look so tall, do they?
And so...
Maybe we went the wrong way all night.
So then, you know, we're doing research about, like, where are we going to go hiking, you know? And it's just farther than we thought it was. And it's like, man, we can't travel, like, another 600 kilometers to get to this place, you know? So we ended up going to the Oleni Vuchi Park, which translates to, like, Deer Park or whatever. And, you know, I was going through websites and blogs and forums and TripAdvisor and just really couldn't, like, get, like, take this bus number, go to this bus station, take this train, go here. And so we did find a commuter train, which was the slowest train ever. And then we had this bus ride and another bus ride and bus stations. And it just took us a long time to get there. But getting back, we just took one bus all the way back to the bus station. So we could have, it's almost like one of those things sometimes when you're traveling is getting there, you're, like, trying to figure it all out, and then getting back, it's like, oh, you just go back to the big city.
Anytime you're leaving a big city to go to a small place, it's hard, because there's all these buses going all over the country. And this is not a Russian thing. This is worldwide.
Yeah.
But funneling back into the city, like, everyone's returning to the big city. So you're always going to find the one route back, because it's the only route there is.
So that took us a bit to get there. But, you know, it was beautiful. The camping was so cheap. We paid, like, an entrance fee, basically, and camped there for 2 days. And it was, like, you know, we weren't really sure, like, where to camp. And it was just kind of, like, camp wherever you feel like it, like, free camping, you know, which was great. You know, we really enjoyed it. I guess one of the other things that kind of was surprising for me about like places like this is Russia is a huge country, and it kind of makes me a little disappointed with the U.S., I guess, and maybe just because it is what it is, because the U.S. is the car culture. But you can get to all these small little villages by bus in Russia, no problem.
Yes.
I mean, it takes you a while. I'm not going to say no problem, but it's possible. Whereas, like, in the U.S., you can't just go to these... You can't just go to, like, Phelps, Wisconsin.
No.
You know, like...
Or New Glarus or something.
Yeah, like, you just don't do that, right?
So not possible.
I have to also, like... Even though it was a little bit difficult to find out the information, I have to also remind myself that, yes, it's difficult to find out the information, and it's not, like, all spelled out in English, but it's possible to take a bus to this small little place, you know? And then I'm like, oh, that's actually pretty cool.
But you know what? You're going to hate me for saying this, but it won't matter in, like, 15 years because we'll have self-driving cars.
He's always got to bring something back to self-driving cars.
And you're going to be able to rent them out really, really cheap, and you can just go anywhere you want. And it's going to be really awesome and world-changing.
Until then.
Yeah.
Until then.
All right.
I will say that, yeah, so that was in Yekaterinburg. And in Krasnoyarsk, if you are going to the Trans-Siberian Railway, go to the Stobie Nature Reserve. It's super easy to get to from Krasnoyarsk. It's just like, there's like 5 buses that go there.
Well, it abuts the city. It's like right there, and everybody goes there.
Yeah, so that was really nice. That was easy to do. And also, like, the highlight for me, of course, was hiking along Lake Baikal and getting on some of the Great Baikal Trail and Okhon Island. Like, that was just really great. And it was nice to be on dirt trails in nature with the lake views. Just beautiful. Really beautiful.
Yeah, a lot of giant forests, too, with those birch trees.
Yep.
And then the pine trees. And as we were continuing along the country, the autumn started and trees started changing colors.
And I actually think that the time period in which we were traveling was a good time because it was not the tourist season, a little bit chillier, so you need to bring a jacket. And you're not going to go, like, swimming in Lake Baikal or anything. But we didn't see nearly as many tourists.
No, very few.
And we didn't have any problems booking hostels or guest houses.
No, no trouble,
like,
at all.
None of the places we were staying were like, oh, we're full these nights. Like, it was pretty much easy to find other places to stay. So I think, you know, mid-August to early September was a good time for Russia.
Yeah, and in fact, one hostel, we were trying to book a room, like a private room, and they only had 1 or 2 private rooms. So it was sold out. Like, ah, crap, we got to stay in the dorm room. So we each got beds in an 8-bed dorm room, but there weren't any other people there. So we had the whole room to ourselves anyway. A giant room instead of us.
Take all of our things out and, you know, organize our backpacks and stuff. And yeah, that was cool. So, I mean, I think, you know, that I also really, really enjoyed Okhon Island. A little bit confusing because there wasn't a whole lot of, again, like, direction. Like, it was a little bit confusing about the minibuses and everything and how to get there and stuff. We're used to going to a bus station saying, hey, bus ticket seller lady, can I have a ticket to this place? And she says, sure, this one is full, but you can take the 4 o'clock. And then she gives you a ticket, and then you go on the 4 o'clock. And the minibus thing, like, it probably works fine for locals because they're used to it. But for us, it's just like, there's all these minibuses. They all have the city names on them. You're not sure where they're going, which one is parked where. They kind of, so what happened is they have the bus station, and then along the road that runs parallel to the bus station and perpendicular, there are just a bunch of minibuses, and you just need to, like, find the one that's going to the city you're going to. And they don't really, some of them leave at certain times, and some don't leave until it's full. So you might just get there and, like, sit there and wait for it to fill up.
Yeah, or it could seem kind of random, like they'll leave when there's 4 empty seats because they know there's going to be 4 people that
along the way.
Flag it down along the way.
Yeah, so that was just a little bit like, again, like I'm sure the locals know the system and they can speak the language, they can do it fine, but for us it's like, oh, I just want to buy a bus ticket and just show up at this time and just get on.
Right, but Irkutsk, in specifically that one city, has an awesome information center.
They do. That's very true.
They'll give you all kinds of info.
And they'll help you too.
Everyone there speaks perfect English.
That's
they'll
true.
They'll give you maps. They gave us a whole book of like photos of Irkutsk, all for free.
So definitely recommend going to the information tourist info center in Irkutsk. That will help you. And the bus timetables change. The minibuses, they change their times when it's off season. And so we were kind of right on the cusp of that. And they were able to kind of tell us those time changes. But Okhon Island, once you get there, it's the bumpy, bumpy ride there. But once you get there, it's just like you are free to walk and hike and camp wherever you want to. And that was amazing. We had a couple free nights, just camp wherever we wanted to. You know, and we would have needed like 6 days to really do a proper trek to the north part of the island and back. But we were fine with just being outside and just whatever there. It was just beautiful.
Well, it's one of those things, you're free to do it, but the main reason you're free to do it is because no one does it.
That's true.
And as soon as it becomes well-known, it'll get more regulated, I'm sure.
Right. There's no marked trails. You just kind of hike wherever you want to, which is a little bit weird. Like, when you're used to hiking on a hiking trail that's got, like, marks and stuff. But when you're on an island or you're following a lake, you kind of just can follow the contours of the land. That really helps you out a lot.
Yeah, it wasn't hard to find our route.
I guess the most frustrating thing for me, I loved all of the nature in Russia, and I loved all of the nature in, like, Baikal and Okhon Island, and it was all just beautiful. And I definitely want to go back to that area, maybe travel from the east going west to Lake Baikal, and maybe travel up by Severobaikalsk.
That's it, on the north end of Lake Baikal.
Yeah.
Severobaikalsk.
Yeah, thank you. Up there and do some more Great Baikal trail hiking. But the frustrating thing for me was, and we were on Okhon Island, they put up outhouses because they know people just come and camp. They have a couple of spots that are frequently used in summertime for camping. And so in this outhouse, there's a hole dug. Well, the entire hole was plugged up with people's bags, plastic bags, and water bottles of trash. So you couldn't actually pee in the outhouse. And so the next morning, I went over there to go to the bathroom, and it was like every single tree near that outhouse, someone had gone to the bathroom and thrown their toilet paper there.
Yeah.
And it was like a little white speckle along the landscape of every tree having some teepee there. And that was just frustrating for me because I get it. Like, not everybody else follows Leave No Trace. Not everybody else camps all the time. But, you know, when we camp, we take everything out. We go to the bathroom and we use toilet paper. We put that in our trash bag and we carry it out.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be great if everybody used Leave No Trace policies. Unfortunately, that... a lot of places that just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But luckily there's that app that
Maria
told me about.
That's cool.
That I forget what it's called now.
So this person that we met on the train from Irkutsk to Ulan Ude, she is working on this project in her community to help maintain the nature. And I think it's a great idea. And it's really awesome to hear that locals are wanting to maintain the nature. And that makes me happy.
Yeah, I think attitudes are changing, for sure. And things will get better.
Yeah.
And I've seen much worse, trust me.
We've definitely seen much worse. So this is nothing compared to places we've seen, like, in China or other places where, you know, but it's just when you have, and it's one of those things, like, you can't, I'm not sure as a traveler, like, how do you teach others how to do this, you know, because it's not really your community and you're just passing through.
Yeah.
So it's hard to know. Like, it's not like you really have any influence. You just...
Nah, you just come off as an asshole when you do that.
It's true. It's true.
So, like, you just step into someone else's culture and, like, here's how you should do things.
Yeah.
So you just have to literally hold your nose in some cases or figuratively and look the other way sometimes. And
I guess just for me, I'll just follow the process for myself to know that I'm not contributing to it is all you can really do.
Yeah, or maybe pick up a few pieces of trash here and there and bring them out, knowing that it's just going to get filled up with trash again soon.
True.
Yeah, that's one of the downsides of travel, is seeing nature get destroyed like that.
But I do think after leaving Lake Baikal, it was pretty special. The train ride from Irkutsk to Ulan-Ude was the most beautiful train ride I have ever been on, especially during this time of the year. So if you travel in Russia in the fall, that train ride is a must-do. It basically goes all the way along the belly of the bottom of Lake Baikal.
Yeah, you're skirting the south end of Lake Baikal all day. So seeing these giant landscapes of this huge lake with mountains in the background covered in trees that in our case were bright orange and yellow because it's fall.
Right.
All day.
That was beautiful. And then we get to watch the sunset. So it's sort of like one of our last train rides in Russia. We were like riding off into the sunset as we were kind of inching toward the end of our Russian trip. And that was, you know, that was special.
We were cowboys.
Hey, cowboys.
Or cowboy, cowgirl. I don't know. What's the politically correct term?
Whatever.
Anyway, then we had one final train ride out of the country, and that was to Mongolia.
And that night we also had an amazing sunset. Another riding off into the sunset experience.
Yeah, if I hadn't gotten deathly ill that night, it would have been really awesome.
That was pretty funny. That car, on our train ride from Ulan-Ude to Ulaanbaatar, it was like we met this kid who had basically taken the train from Moscow all the way to Mongolia with no stops. And for a long time, he had that whole car to himself, and he said he thought he'd have, like, fellow travelers to hang out with and all by himself. So, but he knew that car inside out.
Like, he didn't just have the berth to himself. He had the whole car.
Yeah, like, of, like, 10 berths.
Yeah, like, 40 people are in this car when it's full.
It was full on the way into Mongolia.
Yeah.
So he knew, like, exactly which windows opened and which windows didn't open. And so as soon as there'd be, like, a good, like, landscape shot, like, I'd be like, hey, oh my gosh, it's a really pretty shot. Now, he's taken, the only pictures he's taken of Russia are from the train. And it's mostly just been, like, forest. And now all of a sudden the landscape is changing. And, you know, we're going to Mongolia and he's seeing the sunset and everything. And he's just, like, opened, he knew exactly which window to open. And the whole car comes out every time he took a picture. And so it'd be like a happy hour out there every time that this kid would take a picture.
Yeah, the scramble, everybody's sticking their hands out the window with their camera in their hand. Yeah.
It was pretty funny. That was like our only experience traveling with all foreigners, too. Every other train ride, it was us and mostly Russians.
Pretty much all Russians on the trains. But then this one was an international train, so
that's true.
Makes sense. Everybody was a foreigner.
Right, that's true.
This time, though, leaving the country, I mean, the part where we got stamped out and then got stamped in, that part was actually pretty quick.
Yeah.
They didn't really ask any questions. They didn't search us or anything. They just very, very easy formality. But the train itself had to stop for quite a long time at both borders, probably a couple hours at each. So it took maybe like 4 or 5 hours to get across the border. And by the time we were through, it was like 1 or 2 in the morning.
I think you can also take a bus and travel by bus, and the bus is quicker, but that wasn't an option for us because we had to have that train ticket booked in order to get our visa.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think we probably could have just not taken that train and taken a bus instead, but yeah, that's boring. Trains are much better.
It's true. I'm a train guy.
I'm a train guy. So we woke up on the train in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, and that's where we're going to leave you. I'll definitely talk about Mongolia because we've been here like 10 days now and we've done a lot. And like I said at the beginning, time is just flying by and just seems like forever now since we've even been to Russia.
I kind of feel like, you know, the whole traveling thing, it's like what we do now. You know what I mean? Like kind of like you start a new job and you kind of get the flow of your job. Like after a month in Russia, I kind of feel like this is just, you know, I've got the flow.
This is life.
Yeah,
it's happened to me in South America, too. The first 3 weeks or so, it was like, yay, I'm on vacation. This is great. I'm going to run around and do vacation things and do touristy things, join tours, take a bunch of photos. And
Yeah, I'm not really thinking that way at all. I really feel like I need my time for yoga. I need my time for balance. I need my time for cooking. Like, I'm really trying to make sure that I maintain that balance. But then again, we're older now. You know, when you went to South America, you were 25.
27, yeah.
27. But so you're learning how to become a traveler, too.
I might as well have been, like, 16. So, you know, I had to learn a lot, for sure. And now I still have to learn a lot, I'm sure. But
we have a style. We definitely have a travel style.
Yeah. And we're just going to continue that for the next, 9-10 months or so? And we'll see how long that goes.
We'll see if I get invited back on the podcast. So it'll be a surprise if you hear me again.
Yeah, but until then, any final words on Russia?
I think that it definitely is worth a trip. It's definitely a place you want to give some time to. It's a place that you do kind of have to do a little bit of research before you go. There's a lot of places that I go to that we just kind of show up and kind of figure it out when we get there. Maybe have a few things in mind that are, you know, outdoor adventures they want to do, but the rest we just figure it out day by day. But for Russia, you kind of got to do a little planning in advance because you got to book train tickets. You know, it's a big place, and you've got a timeline.
Yeah, actually, on that note, though, I think if you go maybe at the height of the tourism season, mm-hmm. maybe that's really true. I was worried about that just because we've lived in China, and we know the trains sell out. They always sell out weeks in advance. Russia, though, a lot of the trains that we were on weren't that full. They were still
that's
empty
true.
Beds.
That's true. What I think was, sorry to interrupt you, but the second class and third class, do you want to talk about that?
Oh, okay, we can do that a little bit.
You actually liked third class.
Kind of like third class a little more, even despite the price difference.
I mean, the difference is the door, and there's 200 people in your area, but because it wasn't totally full.
Yeah, it just seems more spacious because you're not closed into a room.
And yeah, you can stretch out a bit more. Just one of those things, don't let that scare you off. Like, don't let, like, the thought of second class, third class, on Russian trains anyways. I know in some other places that's a big difference in quality, but, you know, we did take third class for a two-night train ride, and it was okay for us. It was fine.
Wow, it was great.
And we met more people, and so it was not a problem, really.
The one downside of third class versus second is if you're on the upper bed in third class, you cannot sit up.
Oh, I see.
You can only sit up on the lower bed. And on second class, you can sit up on upper or lower.
I see, right. Overall, I think, you know, if you're into nature, Russia's a good place to go. And if you like riding on the train, it's a great place to go. Really, riding on the train is really therapeutic for me because it's kind of one of those chances to really get unplugged. You know, like all you can do is read and think and dream and sleep.
Look out the window. Let's not forget about that.
Yeah, well, of course. That's part of the thing.
Daydreaming, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And I just love the rhythm of the train. Yeah, rocks in sleep like
Dan,
a baby.
Dan is basically singing in the train, the train classy class. He just loves this. Such a train nerd.
Yeah. All right, well, let's wrap it up right there. We've been going for quite a while. Take care, everybody. Talk to you next time. Thank you guys once again so much for listening. I hope you found this podcast valuable or at least a little bit entertaining. If you want to help me out a little bit, I'd really appreciate it if you'd tell your friends about this show, and maybe you could even leave me a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And as usual, you can always go to my website for more information about the places we talked about. My website is 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number, 1000daysbetween.com. I've got a lot more in store for you as we head through Mongolia, which is where we are right now, and listening to the shithouse being complete. All right, talk to you next time, folks. Look forward to more awesome information about Mongolia.